Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, why is new evangelization so badly needed? We find out more by speaking to an Indian cardinal who will be one of the participants at the upcoming Synod of Bishops in the Vatican reflecting on this theme. Romania, an international hotspot for modern slavery. We shine the spotlight on this flourishing trade in vulnerable human beings with the help of a Caritas official who's just returned from the country. And the dangers of the EU's growing appetite for biofuels. We hear from the charity Oxfam, who says the spiralling production of biofuels is spelling hunger for millions of the world's poorest people. It's just 2 weeks away from the opening in the Vatican of a three-week special synod of bishops that will reflect on the theme of new evangelization. So why is new evangelization so badly needed? And what do the faithful believe the church should do to help modernize its evangelization methods? To find out more about the challenges facing the church on this issue, I spoke to Cardinal Oswald Gracius, Archbishop of Bombay, who has been chosen as one of the Synod Fathers to attend this gathering that opens on October the 7th and runs until the 28th.
I was a bit surprised, but feel privileged that the Holy Father has asked me to come and join in this big collaborative effort to reflect on new evangelization. So humbled in that sense. For me, I would think it's an opportunity to learn also, to learn from the experts, people so much more experienced than myself, and to hear what's happening all over the world, and to plan also for us, ourselves, here in this own archdiocese, in the country, and in Asia.
How important an issue is new evangelization, in your view?
I would think it's so very relevant and important. I always have felt that we're moving, society is moving God away from the center to the periphery. And so it's so essential. Really, it's a solution to an answer to the many problems that we are having in our own country, in Asia, in the world. Dissatisfaction, restlessness. In India, there's a very strong movement against corruption, and everybody is feeling disgusted about it and wanting to clean up the system. Now, you could make all this as a sign that there is a need for ethics, for order, for justice, for law, and for God, finally, basically. So new evangelization is something which everybody needs, I think. Civil society, the church needs, we need, priests, bishops, all of us need this.
And what measures have you decided on so far there in India as to how to put into practice this need for a new evangelization, taking advantage of the new technologies that are available to preach the gospel? What sort of concrete measures have been taken so far?
We've been thinking, really, still at the planning stage. But one thing is our social communications commissions have been seeing how we could use the new modern means of media and technology to reach out, particularly to the youth, you see. Think of India as a very young country. 50% of our population is below 35, and it's really young and it's powerful. Asia is young, and so we're really concentrating a lot on the youth, how the gospel could be given to them, and they understand the gospel in their language, an answer to their problems. The question of also, I think everybody is feeling a necessity of understanding the faith, the Catholic faith among ourselves, more and deeper. Whenever we have now our archdiocese over here, faith formation programs, they are filled with sort of it's everybody, all the applications are filled, all the seats taken. So really, it's a felt need. So I think that on this context, we'll have lots of programs on faith formation. It's an occasion for us to, it's the 20th anniversary of the Catholic Catechism, the 50th of the Vatican Council, and there's so much to learn, so much to understand, so much richness, and to be able to appreciate also the glory of the Catholic faith and the person of coming closer to the person of Jesus Christ.
When it comes to new evangelization, the growing secularization, particularly in Western countries, is seen as a major challenge for the church. Do you see signs of that growing secularization even in India, which of course is traditionally probably a far more religious place than, say, much of Western Europe is nowadays. But as the country gets more prosperous, do you fear that in some ways secularization could get a grip over the place?
Exactly. I've been saying that my own city of Mumbai over here is like the window to the West, and the media is just flooding us with ideas which come from outside, and this is impacting the people very much, particularly the youth, really impacting them very much, the ideas. And secularization is certainly creeping in rather clearly, steadily into our society. And therefore, we've got to get back. That's why I think that's a priority for us, to get back to our roots, get back to our Asian spirituality, get back to our values, and not allow us to be blown off our feet by what's coming in. And it is a need, absolutely a need.
And what do the faithful say to you? What would they like to see the church do to, let's say, modernize, in a way, its way of preaching the gospel?
They would like to have, I would think, homilies which are more relevant, liturgy which is more lively, communities which reach out more to the poor, and witness which is really authentic, showing the face of Jesus to people. That, I think, is people want it. It's challenging, but it's something we've got to reflect on and make a reality in our lives.
You talked there about the threats posed by secularization. Do you believe that also a greater emphasis on material goods that is so present now in modern society throughout the world is also a threat to the Christian message?
Yes, it is a threat in the sense that we must have proper perspectives. I think we, fortunately, India is not blown off the feet of getting so materialistic, values are still there. But there's a danger that it could happen, that takes priority over everything else. And therefore, the gospel should really take roots more in the whole of society, showing us that material things are what our Lord came to show us. This is a means towards happiness, towards a good life, towards a better world. But it's not absolutely everything. We are pilgrims on our way to our heavenly home. And so material things are to be given their importance, but they're the second place to real spiritual values.
So what do you expect will emerge eventually at the end of the deliberations of this synod?
As I was saying, for me it's going to be a learning experience to hear and reflect. We've already discussed about this before in the preparation of the synod, but now we're to hear really what's happening all over the world. I expect that when we come back, we'll have rather clear ideas of we learn from the success stories and the problems for other places, and we are able to go ahead. In my own archdiocese, we're having a sort of a synod next month in November, so soon after the synod, the diocesan program. The theme again is re-evangelization, a new evangelization in the archdiocese. So again, it's the same direction. So for me, it's very, very relevant, and I think the same would be all over India and Asia too. We are having our plenary for the Asian Bishops' Conferences in November also after that. And there too, absolutely positively, we'll take all these ideas there to try to implement them. It's coming in a very, very appropriate time.
And without asking you to reveal any secrets, what do you think will be the main thrust of your intervention at this synod? What do you want to concentrate on?
Yeah, I want to concentrate on the problems and the situation of Asia and what we see. It may not be relevant for the whole world, but what we see as the direction the Asian church should take in future. Traditionally, we've always said there are three big areas: the diversity of cultures, the great economic problems of the place, and the plurality of religions. So these are the three characteristic features of Asia: culture, religion, and poverty of the place, of many places, which we've got to address. And the gospel has got to answer these situations and have really a direction for us.
I was speaking to Cardinal Gracius, Archbishop of Bombay. Experts say that Romania is an international hotspot for modern slavery, with the country being used as a major source and destination for this highly profitable trade in vulnerable human beings. Laura Sheehan of Caritas Internationalis has just returned from a fact-finding visit to Romania, where she spoke to several former victims of human trafficking. She also saw at first hand what Caritas and the local Catholic Church are doing to both boost awareness of the dangers of being trafficked and provide support for victims to help their rehabilitation into normal society. She spoke to me about her impressions and shared the stories of those who are trying to build a new life after escaping from the clutches of their unscrupulous traffickers.
It's really hard to get specific numbers because this is criminal activity. It's underground, basically. But the problem is very widespread. And yes, I was in one town where the priest was telling me that in a cafe that he started to help at-risk women, traffickers actually even come into the cafe. So this is a big, big problem in Romania.
And this priest that you met in this town, how does he seek to stop people from falling into the hands of the traffickers? Because obviously you need awareness here of the dangers posed, not to believe these smooth-talking strangers, presumably.
Yes, exactly. These smooth-talking strangers will come up to a teenage girl or perhaps a child who's living in the street or whose parents are both working abroad and who isn't being taken care of. And the stranger will get to know them, you know, maybe give them presents, act like a very nice person and actually help them in small ways. Once they've sort of lured them into the trap, then these human traffickers will often take them into other countries and, for example, sell the girls into prostitution or sell the children into beggary, where they have to beg on the streets and give all the money to the human trafficking network. So it's a terrible problem.
Anyhow, tell us some more about this priest, Father Petru. You said he was an amazing character and the work he did was absolutely incredible.
He's a wonderful man. He's helped a lot of women who are seriously at risk. What's happening in Romania is that some children are growing up in orphanages, even if both of their parents are still alive. Sometimes a family will give their child to a state-run orphanage if they simply can't take care of the child. And unfortunately, in these orphanages, as we know from the news in years past, there are a lot of problems, abuses, and the kids, when they leave, they usually have nowhere to go, they have no money, they have no families, so they're very much at risk in terms of trafficking. So what Father Petru does is he focuses often on such at-risk people who have nowhere to go, and he's created jobs, for example, a tailoring shop, a cafe, there's a farm where they make cheese, they have cows. So there are these jobs for these at-risk women. There's also a Catholic school where their children can go to school, and he provides job training. So it's really a wonderful sort of circle of services he provides to women who might otherwise have no options. Even if they were aware of the dangers, they might feel they had to take a chance because they just have no money and nothing else to do.
But as you mentioned earlier, it's not just trafficking for women who are being forced into prostitution. There's also children that are being trafficked, even babies that are being trafficked. You came across one case, I gather.
Yes, I was really astonished to hear this one case of basically a baby being trafficked. The mother had gotten pregnant at 16, was not married, and because of stigma, her baby was basically sold without her knowledge. The baby was taken from Romania to Spain. The boy grew up with what he called his false family in Spain. They made him beg, they made him steal, they beat him a lot. As he grew older, he would try to run away so often that they would actually chain him.
Chain him to what?
He didn't say, but it sounded like maybe to a bed or something like that. So it was a terrible story. So finally he escaped. Finally he got away and he actually found his birth mother. And
how did he manage that?
He actually escaped while he was with his false family in Romania. And at night, while they were sleeping, he boarded a train and escaped to Bucharest, the capital of Romania. And from there he found his birth mother. The police started putting the case together. And thankfully his traffickers are now in jail.
And what about that child? I mean, is he still very traumatized by his terrible experiences of being basically a slave from a baby onwards?
From what I understand from his psychologist and caseworkers, he was very traumatized at the beginning when he was 11 and first came back. Now he's doing wonderfully well. He's caught up in school amazingly fast. He's very intelligent. He really cares about his mother and is getting to know his stepsister, and they have a good relationship. And he's doing so well in school that he even participated in a science Olympiad and did very well.
So a happy story there. But how many other cases are there of babies or very, very young children, at any rate, being seized for trafficking purposes? Is it common as far as we can gather?
I couldn't say about babies, but it does seem like a lot of child trafficking is happening in terms of beggary. A lot of tourist spots in France, in Spain, possibly in England, the children that you see begging are not begging for themselves or their own families. their money is confiscated by the traffickers.
And they're often coming from Romania, you're saying?
Yeah, a lot of them are from Romania or other poor countries.
And the kids are nearly always Romanian?
Yes, for the most part.
Were there any other particularly shocking or brutal case of trafficking that you came across during your trip that you'd like to share with us?
Well, you know, there are basically three major kinds of human trafficking. There's the trafficking for beggary, as I discussed. There's the sex trafficking. And there's trafficking for forced labor, where you hire people, you tell them you're going to give them a certain salary, you take them to another country, usually to a fairly remote place where they don't know the language, they don't have a contract, they don't know how to reach the police. And you basically force them to work for free or almost for free. So I heard about one Romanian woman who was offered a job in Italy, seasonal work, picking grapes and olives. She didn't have a contract. She was told they'd make 50 euros a day. When she showed up, they didn't pay nearly as much as they had promised. Plus, they were urging some of the young, pretty girls, as she put it, in the group, to prostitute themselves. They said, wouldn't you like a better job than picking grapes? So this was an example of forced labor trafficking that also sort of turned into sex trafficking.
I mean, but was she forced into prostitution, or did she sort of decide that she didn't want to do that?
She was able to resist, and she said no. She was a little older, I think just a little more worldly wise, and she did resist, and she managed to get away.
You also mentioned that during your trip you heard a lot about the so-called lover boy phenomenon, which is a guy who finds a vulnerable girl and becomes her boyfriend, but in actual fact he's planning to groom her to be trafficked, you know, to work as a sex slave in forced prostitution. Can you tell us a bit more about this phenomenon?
Sure. The lover boy phenomenon is especially disturbing because this young man, usually handsome and kindly, will really get to know a girl. He won't just sort of meet her as a stranger in the street. He might know her family or be a friend of a cousin or something like that. He'll really get to know her. He'll meet her family. He'll give her gifts. He'll really seem interested in her welfare. I actually heard of one case where the man wasn't even romantically involved with the girl. He just pretended to be a very good friend, and he would buy her medicine when she was sick, for example. So they really pretend to care about these girls. And then they'll say, I've heard about a job abroad where you can go to Norway and be a nanny. Or I've heard about this restaurant in Spain where you and I can work together and save money and then get married. And then they take them across the border. Usually these girls are 18 or over. So it's not a case of child trafficking. So it's harder to stop them at the border, especially if the girl says, no, he's my boyfriend, I love him. They go across the border and then he sells her into a brothel or some sort of sex work.
And is this a growing trend as far as you can gather?
The lover boy trend has been around for a while. It seems to be sort of holding steady. Traffickers seem to know now that they can't just find vulnerable girls through internet ads or newspaper ads or, you know, just meet them once or twice. They seem to know that they have to build a relationship with these young women. So it's really disturbing the way that traffickers will just manipulate people and exploit their trust.
And prey on the vulnerable.
Exactly. They find the girl whose father is an alcoholic or who is having trouble in school or came from an orphanage and has nowhere to go or who is just very upset and having a hard time and needs someone to talk to who seems to care about her. So these traffickers are good psychologists and they're almost like shapeshifters. They keep changing their tactics. It's really despicable what they do.
And what kind of feedback do you get from the victims of trafficking about the work that Caritas is doing in the local country to try to both increase awareness of this problem and to help with the rehabilitation of the victims once they've been rescued?
The victims are so grateful for the help they're receiving from Caritas and from our partners. Caritas runs a group called CoatNet, which is Christian Organizations Against Trafficking. And it's a network of Christian church groups, basically, throughout Europe and in Asia and other places. So we're the people who maybe have a little more sympathy for them than their neighbors or even their family members. A lot of times the family doesn't understand and they say, how could you do this? Especially when it's been sex trafficking. There's a lot of stigma and a lot of rejection. So Caritas and our CoatNet partners are trying to show the women that it's not their fault. Something bad was done to them. They didn't do something bad. And we try and help them. We provide shelters. We provide counseling. We try to get them jobs. We try and help them reintegrate into society. So they've been very grateful for the help. And I remember one woman saying, you know, I feel safe with you because you're trying to get us good jobs and safe jobs. And those are the important things to a lot of people who have been victimized.
But what about the awareness issue? Because this is crucial also to stop them becoming victims in the first place. Mrs. Caritas helping on that front as well?
Yeah, Caritas and other CoatNet partners are doing a lot of awareness raising and prevention work. So in Romania, I visited a Catholic high school where we really get the high school students involved. They actually made a video that you can see on YouTube. They make t-shirts. They actually go out in the street and wear the costume where a person was sort of in a box, showing that human trafficking can put people in a box. So they go out on the street and actually talk to people about the issue. So we're really trying to target the people who would be most vulnerable, people who are young, who maybe don't know what they're going to do next, especially because the unemployment rate in Romania is so high. They might be very vulnerable to very strange job offers that sound plausible but are dangerous.
These people who are trafficked, they can end up in countries throughout Europe, right? Oh, do you know which are the most popular, shall we say, host destinations?
I couldn't quite say which are the most popular, but trafficking is happening everywhere. There was a terrible recent case in the UK called the Cinderella case, where a little girl was trafficked, and also a man around 50 was forced to beg and steal and just do terrible things. So it's happening in the United States, it's happening in the UK, it's happening in Europe, it's happening in Asia. All the places where you think it can't be happening, it probably is. One big problem is simply the demand. As long as there's demand for prostitutes or for cheap labor on a farm or cheap construction labor, trafficking is going to continue. So countries really have to think about the demand issue and who's trying to get this cheap labor or who's trying to get these kids or these young women. They really have to look at that and try and fight what's happening.
I was speaking to Laura Sheehan of Caritas Internationalis about human trafficking in Romania. The British charity Oxfam is calling for the EU to rethink what it calls its dangerous love affair with biofuels. In a new report, Oxfam warns that Europe's growing appetite for these type of fuels is pushing up global food prices and driving people off their land, resulting in deeper hunger for millions in the world's poorest countries. Current EU law requires 10% of transport energy to come from renewable sources by 2020, with almost all of it expected to come from biofuels made from food crops. Oxfam says by 2020, these biofuel mandates alone could push up the price of some foods by as much as 36%. This would affect us all, but would have a particularly severe impact on poor people, who are already struggling to afford the food they need to survive. Max-Olivier Herman works for Oxfam's European Union office and is an expert on biofuels. I began by asking him whether he believes the EU will heed Oxfam's call to rethink its policy on biofuels.
We hope so. The European Commission has been sending rather positive signals in the past 2 weeks. On a number of occasions, they have been saying that they think that we should limit the use of food crops to produce biofuels. To us, that sounds like a step in the right direction. And we do hope that at long last, European policymakers understand that this policy is unsustainable, ethically wrong, and counterproductive.
You say it spells hunger for millions. Where have people been most affected by this rise in food prices resulting from the cultivation of biofuels?
So those most directly affected by rises on the global food price markets are those living in countries, in poor countries that are heavily dependent on imports satisfy their food needs, and within those countries, particularly urban populations. So the most extreme example would be a country like Yemen, who imports basically all of its foodstuffs. Other countries are less directly impacted by rises on global food markets, effects of this policy in terms of pressures on land. And so this policy is driving large-scale land acquisitions in developing countries, which is pushing small farmers off their land.
Crop-based biofuels were billed in the past as a clean, renewable fuel that could help wean us off our dependence on fossil fuels and help reduce climate change. Is Oxfam saying now that all that was wrong and that we should stop altogether the cultivation of biofuels because of the effects they are having on food production and hence on poverty levels, especially in developing nations?
What Oxfam is saying is that the current generation of biofuels, which is made from food crops, is having totally unacceptable effects, both in terms of impacts on food prices, on land, on water, and on climate, because many of these biofuels, if you take into account the complete carbon footprint, are actually worse than fossil fuels. So Oxfam thinks that the current policy with the currently available biofuels is wrong. However, we do think that we should keep on investing in research and development to develop probably more advanced biofuels that are not land-based, that do not compete with food, and that can help us solve the issue of emissions from transport. However, the truly long-term structural solutions to the emissions from transport in the EU are to change the transport policies, to reduce demand for energy, so to shift to other modes of transport, to electrify light road transport. So we need a rethink of our policies, and that will also solve the issue of energy security, which was also at the base of this policy.
The cultivation of biofuels has increased enormously. I don't know if you could give me some figures. And I gather also there's some subsidies, aren't they, to promote this cultivation?
Yeah, so biofuels in the EU has risen extremely rapidly over the last years because of the policies in place and because of the subsidies. So currently we're about at 4.5% of the energy needs in the transport sector that are covered by biofuels. And by 2020, that's going to be close to 10%. So every time someone in the UK or in France tanks, then basically there's a significant proportion of biofuels that's being tanked. And because we have no choice, consumers have to buy biofuels, it's also subsidizing an industry which could not survive without these mandates that are in place. And that comes at a cost of 7 billion euros a year. So it is a very costly policy. And we could use that money much more intelligently, both to solve our energy and climate problems and to help developing countries.
And as you said earlier, it's not an ethical policy either.
Yes, we're living in a world where close to 1 billion people are hungry, where children die of malnutrition, and we're taking food and putting it in the tanks of our cars. So that, I think, is entirely unacceptable.
I was speaking to Max Olivier Herman, an expert on biofuels, who works for Oxfam's European Union office.
If you have an Android smartphone, then visit our website and download Vatican Radio's first app. It's free. The application contains an agenda that lets you access text and audio content associated with the Pope's public events, while informing you in real time about papal celebrations broadcast live. A news service provides the latest information on the Church and the world, while a radio section links you to Vatican Radio's 5 audio channels and its 40 different language services. Audio, video, text, news, editorials, live broadcasts, all in a single app. Go to our website at www.radiovaticana.va and click on the icon in the upper right-hand corner. The version for iPhone and iPad is coming soon.
Well, that's all from me, Susie Hodges, here at Vatican Radio's English programme. But we'll be back on the air at the same time tomorrow, so be sure to join us then if you can. And don't forget, you can always find our programmes on the internet at www.radiovaticana.va. Laudato Jesus Christus.